everybody.
So I need to thank the committee. Cindy and I have been meaning to get up here for a couple years. There's always something going on. October's busy, budget's tight, yada, yada, yada. So I want to thank you all for inviting us up. We get to hang out with friends, new and old, and I appreciate that. I'm alcoholic. I'm a member of the Downtown Dry Dock Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is February 28th, 1991, and my name's John.
Hey, John.
Hey. So, I can't stay sober by myself. I learned that in AA, of all places. Go figure, right? And, you know, my plan tonight is just to tell some stories about me. And I have cards because I hurt myself mentally out there for years, you know, before 91. And so I need help remembering stuff. But anyway, to qualify, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, in a family of drinkers. Family get-togethers, holidays, etc., drunk. And dad was a great guy, went to work every day, but there was always drinking. I just didn't think anything was wrong with that. So the big tragedy in my childhood was my mom got breast cancer and died when I was 8. I had that kind of shaded my whole childhood. In hindsight, and you know, clarity of sobriety, it only lasted about 9 months from the diagnosis to death. But you know, I kind of used that my whole life, and so at that age, I was 8, and I had already gotten loaded. I had already drank for the effect. So I was a little kid, and I was getting loaded. At 8, I was spending time in a place that this place reminds me of, Betterton, Maryland. It's the middle of nowhere. It's just cornfields and rednecks. And we had this a family that we knew had cabins on a river, and we spent our summers there. I was over there. My brother was doing Little League or something. And my maternal grandmother was living with us to help because dad was working. And my maternal grandmother was not an easy woman to get along with. German-Irish, she would argue with herself, you know. And I forgot, this is on a tape, but anyway. She was, you know, Nana. And Nana was home, and I was with my older sister, who was 6 years older than me, and her friends thought it would be fun to get the little guy loaded and see what happened. So we called home to brag about it, and Grandma was listening. So a family that was already in crisis had another crisis, you know, and I was not helping, and I was a part of the problem, and I didn't even know it, you know. So I'm 8 years old, and I'm busted. A few years later, I kept drinking, kept getting loaded, kept hanging out with older kids. At 12, I was drinking with some friends, older friends, a couple blocks away from my house. I lived in Baltimore City, and was drinking Seagram 7 and 7. I was very cosmopolitan for a 12-year-old, let me tell you. But anyway, we're drinking 7 and 7s, and I drank a lot. I was a pig when I drank, and I drank a lot. I remember making my way home. It was a couple blocks from my house. I remember it was like February. I remember falling down in the snow and ice and making it home and getting into the living room and turning the television on, and I passed out. And to date myself, the Carol Burnett Show was on, and it wasn't a rerun. And so that's the time frame, right? And love that show. And when my parents got home, my father had remarried. When my father and my stepmother got home that evening, with a couple that they had gone out to dinner with, my father tried to wake me up, and I proceeded to throw up all over his Italian loafers, which he didn't really appreciate. And he dragged me to Greater Baltimore Medical Center, where they pumped my stomach. I found out the next morning from the ER doc that I had overdosed on alcohol. That's what he told me. He said, John, you've had an overdose of alcohol. I had the charcoal. If anybody's ever had that, charcoal down my chin. And I was 12, you know. And I remember thinking, oh, they're just trying to ruin my high, man, you know. And so I kept drinking. And a couple years later, I think it was 15, I was at a friend's graduation party, from high school graduation party, keg party. Got very loaded, as usual. Left the party. I was a good leaver. You know, I would have come to understand in inventory work is I left. You know, I was very good at leaving. And so I left the party to get to another friend's house. And this was in Northwood, which is a place in Baltimore where there's row houses, which we call townhouses now because you can sell them for more money, but really they're houses in a row, right? And go figure. And the front lawn is vertical. There's no front lawn. It's just vertical. So they plant this stuff called ivy, which I found very comforting as a young alcoholic. So I passed out in somebody's ivy on the way to my friend's house. Whoever lived there didn't appreciate it. They called the police. Police came. I came out of that blackout, hogtied, you know, handcuffs behind my back, feet handcuffed, and those two handcuffs handcuffed together, face first in a metal paddy wagon. We used to call them paddy wagons. And I ended up in the drunk tank for the first time. So that's my alcoholism in a nutshell. I'm 8, I'm busted, I'm 12, I'm hospitalized, and I'm 15, and I'm incarcerated. All a direct result of alcoholism, which was a disease I didn't even know I had, right? I'm like, what's that, you know? I just like partying, man. That was me, you know? Just like partying. So, my drinking never got better, you know? It got worse. Alcoholism got worse for me. I was 15. I drank until I was 27, and it never got better. I got better at things like disappearing. I got better at not showing up, at leaving. I would go out on dates with women and get drunk to the point where I just left. You know, I get a call the next day. Where the hell did you go? I'm like, well, I was done. You're like, you're damn right you're done. You'll never see me again, right? Like, that was it with that one. But that's the kind, I was just so self-absorbed, you know, I didn't think like that, just how I thought. And I got a lot better at all the self-centered stuff, but the alcoholism got worse. And I didn't even know I had alcoholism. I didn't even know alcoholism was a disease. So I got through high school. I went to a really good high school, a Jesuit high school. I do really well on Jeopardy, if anybody can relate to that. But I never applied myself. Anybody ever heard that one? John's a good guy, but he doesn't apply himself, you know? That was me. And I got C's, and I didn't even try, you know? And I got through high school, and I do well on Jeopardy, but I didn't go to college. So I wanted to work on boats, so I went to New Orleans. Brilliant idea for a young alcoholic, let me just say that right now. 24-hour town, drink, drink, drunk. So there I was. And I had a wonderful time in New Orleans. I started a career in Merchant Marines. I'm a boat guy. And I met some wonderful people, heard some great music, and some of it I even remember, you know, but most of it I don't, which is kind of sad. In hindsight, I look back and I'm like, wow, I heard, you know, B.B. King, I heard Roy Orbison, I heard people that I never would have heard otherwise, you know. And I kind of missed most of it because I was too busy getting loaded. So I was there for about 5 years, and through a series of different things, oil field downturn in Houston closing up, and I was in a helicopter wreck, a couple other little details, you know, that I'm not going to gloss over. I ended up back in Maryland where I met Cindy. And so here's the story. Here's that story. I met Cindy. We started having children, and I started getting DUIs in that order. That's what the card says. I'm not just making this up. So she said last night that my last drunk was at a Grateful Dead concert. I'm here to correct her. It was at a Bob Dylan concert. And I know because I was so drunk, I understood everything he said. Hey, thank you very much. I know, right? It was bad, let me tell you. So that's the guy that came to you in AA. You know, I was the guy who left his pregnant wife and his 5-year-old son to go get loaded at a Bob Dylan concert. And I didn't think anything was wrong with that until I came to you and got a sponsor who started pointing out how ridiculously self-centered that is. So I'm going to tell you about my first meeting. My first meeting was sobriety on Fridays at Emerton Baptist Church in Emerton, Maryland, which is north of Baltimore, where we live. We lived in a little town north of Baltimore, Edgewood. And I was terrified. I had called my sister, who had been sober about 3 years, and I said, "Ann, I'm in trouble. I'm probably going to lose my job. Probably going to lose my house. And I'm probably going to lose Cindy, Matthew, and whatever's cooking inside of her." And that was kind of my mentality. That was kind of what I cared about: job, house, family. Because I was a guy, and I learned later, I was a guy who loved things and used people. And in AA, I got to turn that around, which is pretty awesome. But at the time, I was a very sick individual. So sick, I didn't even know I was sick. So I go to this, I call my sister and I say, "This is what's going to happen." And she says, "I think you should go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and see if you can relate to anything anyone says." And this is when we had phones on the wall. You know, if I could have thrown the phone, I'd have thrown it. I was so mad. I remember thinking, that's the worst advice I've ever gotten in my life, you know. Because she had never talked to me about AA. She had never said, "You're a lousy brother, husband, son," all the things I was. She had just gotten sober and lived her life and become a healthy, happy young individual. And what I said, I thought all those things, and what I said was, okay, I was done, you know. I didn't know I was done, but I was done. So I went to sobriety on Fridays. I said to Cindy, "Ann thinks I should go to AA," and Cindy's exact words, "Good for Ann." It wasn't a really great week at the house, I'm just saying, you know. Things were not really great. And you know how they do. She came around the next day or two and said, "You know, they have a meeting at the church I go to." And I said, "Well, I can't go there. Those people know me. I go on Mother's Day, you know." She said, "It's okay. They've been praying for you, you jackass." So I went to Emerton Baptist Church. And here's Emerton Baptist Church. I'll lay this out for you. Big brick old church. Huge parking lot. One light on the side of the church, three cars next to the light. I park out here. That's me, right? Keen alcoholic mind. I park way out here with my Ford Ranger, which at this point is round because I kept knocking the edges off of it, you know? So I get out of the truck. I smoke 5 cigarettes on the way to the door. I open the back door, you know, and I smell coffee. And I look around, and there's a light going up these stairs. I smell coffee and I hear voices. I trudge, you know, it's like the Green Mile, you know. Trudge up these steps, and I turn into the right. It's the first door on the right, and there's four guys, and an urn of coffee three times the size of that one. You know what I mean? Three guys, 100 cups of coffee. Welcome to AA. It's a Sunday school room. There's little desks, right, for little kids. I'm like, oh, jeez. What has my life become? So I walk into this room, and the guy who's doing chairing the meeting, what Elena's doing tonight, his name was John P. John Packer. He's still a friend of mine, which is amazing because the guys from the bar quit calling. But John's still a friend of mine, and he chaired the first meeting I ever went to. And John was chairing, and his sponsor, Tom, was talking. Hated Tom instantly. Still not a big fan, but I just didn't like him. You know what I mean? It was one of those things. And so I go in and I'm shaking, you know, I haven't had a drink in 5 days. I'm coming apart, man. I'm sweating. It's February. I'm sweating. You know what I mean? That's the kind of shape I was in. And, I look at them, they're like, "Hey," and I'm like, "Yeah," up to the back of the room and get in my little desk, you know, and, conquer down for the meeting. And they have a meeting, you know, and John reads the readings, and Tom tells his story, and, you know, he was a drunk, and he went to jail, and he lost a family, and he lost a career, and then he came to AA, and now everything's a miracle, and his family, his new family's a miracle, and the coffee's a miracle, and everything's a miracle. And I'm sitting back in my chair vibrating, you know, going, how did I get here, you know? And so at the end of the meeting, John gives me one of these. Come on up, we're going to pray. I'm like, oh, here comes the hook, right? So I get out of my desk, and I walk on up there, you know, come slick, hip, and cool. And we say the Lord, I mumble through the Lord's Prayer, which I kind of remember from Catholic school, kind of. And at the end of it, John pulls me in, and he hugs me. And I'm not a huggable guy at this point in my life. Yeah, my arms are at my sides, and he's giving me the full body hug. This is John. And he's got 4 months to the day. He got sober October 28th, and this was 4 months later. He got sober October 28th, 1990. And my arms are at my sides, and he's giving me the full hug, and I'm like, oh, God, when's it going to stop? And he says, he whispers in my ear, he says, it never has to be like this again. And I'm like, oh, God, get me out of here. You know? How did he know? How did he know how bad it was? Because it was bad. I mean, in my mind, it was bad. I was considering driving into oncoming traffic, and I was not considering the other person I was driving into. I was sick, very sick, and I didn't even know it. And he whispered that in my ear, and something inside me broke. And at the time, I just thought I was losing my mind. I didn't know what happened. So I was like, thanks. He's like, you know. And he turned around to get a meeting schedule or something, and I was, boom, out the door, right? Typical new guy. I'm out the door, and I'm halfway down the steps, and I hear this noise, and the noise is like, uh-huh. And I stopped on the steps, and I looked around. I'm like, what the heck was that? And I kept walking, you know, and then I hear it again, uh-huh. And I realize it's me, and I'm sobbing, and blood, the tears start flying down my cheeks and snot. So it's just disgusting. And I'm like, and I'm like, oh my God. And I'm like losing. Oh, they put something in the coffee. That's what it is. I didn't even have any of the coffee, right? But they did. They dosed me somehow. I don't know. It's a bad trip, man. I got to get out of here. So I run for the door, you know. I run for the door. I get to the door and I throw the door closed across the parking lot, you know. Get to my round truck. Open up. Dip, 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 dip. Come on, open up. Open the door. You know, close the door. The darn light won't go off. I'm trying to light a cigarette. Snot flying. It was just disgusting. And I thought I was losing my mind. You know, in hindsight, I was having a spiritual experience. I was experiencing 1, 2, and 3, steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't know that at the time. I just thought, something's very wrong with me. I'm very broken, which was true. But, you know, I got it together enough to drive home, which is about a 15, 20-minute drive. Made it home, pulled it together. Can't let Cindy see me like this. Okay, we're good. We're good. You know, I looked in the mirror. We're good. Everything's cool. Okay. I walk inside, you know. She's like, how was the meeting? I'm like, it was great. I just lost it, you know what I mean? And I don't think Cindy likes to see me cry too much, but she put up with it that night because she was just so glad I wasn't drunk. And that was my beginning in AA, you know. So that's my first meeting story. It's a good one. So I joined the Gunpowder Group. Sounds like a really tough group. We were on the Gunpowder River. That's why we got named that. We weren't really that bad. But Gunpowder Group was a great group. I get to talk about that a little. I joined the Gunpowder Group Thursday nights, Harford County, 8:30. And they said, you know, we're gonna give you a job. It was a great meeting where you had guys with a lot of time, a lot of service down to me coming in off the street, you know. I wasn't crying anymore, thank God, but I was still a little jittery. And they're like, yeah, well, you can be assistant trash dude, you know what I mean? They didn't want to trust me with the full trash job, you know? God forbid he not stay sober. I was assistant trash dude, you know? I was like, yeah, I got a job, you know? So that was my deal. And I stayed sober and, you know, made it up to trash dude, you know? And then it became like assistant coffee guy, you know, because I made it 6 months or whatever. And then coffee guy, and then, you know, so I became a part of that group, and that was such a wonderful group. At a couple years sober, you know, they started taking me to H&I, which down in Broward County is BCIC, Hospitals and Institutions, changed my life. And I got to go to hospitals and institutions all over the state of Maryland, but we started in Harford County and Cecil County and Baltimore County and then the city and the Maryland State Penitentiary. You know, stories that'll curl your hair and change your life, but just amazing. Guys inside those places want to stay sober. You know, they want to stay sober, and they need guys like us to go in there. So if you get a chance to do that, I would encourage you to do it. I'm probably speaking to the choir here. Anyway, in about 2 years, they let me chair the meeting. Now, at that meeting, you chaired the meeting for 6 months. And so it was a six-month commitment every Thursday night, 8:30. You had to be there early, help set up. And the fourth Thursday of the month was a speaker meeting, so you had to get speakers. So some of the old guys were like, listen, get out of Harford County and find us some people we haven't heard. I'm like, no problem. So, you know, I'm hanging out with John Packard and some other guys, and like Sundays we'd go down into the city, and for some reason I was down in the city. It must have been a government holiday or something. I was working for the federal government at the time, driving boats for the DOD, and I'm down in the city at Hopkins Luncheon, and it's a discussion meeting, and I'm sitting there listening, you know, a guy with 2 years, got a lot to say, but didn't say anything, thank God. So they talked, and this one guy talked, and he just cracked me up. He was funny, but he was smart. So I go up to him after the meeting, you know, Dr. Mackey, when you speak for me at the Gunpowder Group? And he says, is that Paul Wright's group? I remember looking at the guy, speak. Big, tall African-American gentleman. I said, yeah, not knowing what that meant. He said, yeah, I'd love to. I'll be out there in 2 weeks, you know. Give me the date, time, whatever, give me the address. So he comes out and he speaks, and like for the next 3 months, people are like, how did you get Arnold to come out here? He's our delegate, you know, to New York. I'm like, I didn't know. I just thought he was funny, you know. And that's how my sobriety has worked. I've just people, you know, Mike was talking about, other people talked about it this weekend. People have been put in my life that are just incredible human beings. And it's just amazing the level of stuff that they do. And don't even talk about it, but they just do it, you know what I mean, which is awesome. So I got to meet Arnold, and he spoke at our last convention. We got him to speak at another convention for us a while back, about 10 years ago. Just a wonderful guy. So here's the deal about the Gunpowder Group. You know, the reason he came out there, I'm sure, was because Paul was a member of that group. Paul was a past delegate. I didn't know that. I didn't know what a delegate was. I didn't know what GSR was. I hadn't even become an intergroup rep yet, or alternate intergroup rep, that group. We had a lot of positions in that group. And thank God. And so he came out there probably out of respect for Paul Wright, you know, who's passed. But Paul was a wonderful human being. I remember him sitting in business meetings, and there was like almost fist fights going on in business meetings, and Paul was just like Mr. Serene, you know. And I leaned to him one time, I said, are you going to put up with this? You know, because I was one of the ones getting ready to throw a fist. And he said, AA self-flushing. What doesn't work will go away. What's not of God will go away. And that kind of, he would say stuff like that, and I'd just be like, ooh. It's a little heavy there. Whoa, a little self-important, aren't you? But he was such a wonderful human being. So guys like that, all the way down to guys like me shaking in off the street. But Paul's sponsor was a guy named John. John's sponsor was a guy named Lamar, who was almost famous. And Lamar's sponsor was Jim Burwell, whose story's in, I think it's in the third edition, The Vicious Cycle. And his sponsor was Wilson before he moved to Baltimore. That's how close this thing is, you know. Like, we're in the first 100 years of this movement. If you consider this a spiritual movement, which I do, we're in the first 100 years. So what we do matters, you know. When we say the responsibility statement, it's our responsibility, how we carry ourselves. Ralph, my first sponsor, said, don't put a circle and a triangle on your car. What, nobody gets that? Because I drove like an idiot. There you go, now you get it. He said, what you do outside of here tells people what we're teaching you here. So, behave yourself. Thank you, Ralph. So it was only like six steps back to Wilson from my home group, you know. And I know some of you are closer than that. But, so we're responsible. You know, Ralph stopped coming to meetings, my first sponsor, and Ralph saved my life. Cindy mentioned him last night. He brought us home from the hospital when our second child was born because I didn't have a license, because the state of Maryland took my license away, which they should have because I was a maniac and I was driving drunk. I didn't see it that way at the time. At the time, I thought they were a little petty, you know. But anyway, Ralph came to the hospital. It was his birthday when Faith was born, and he came to the hospital the next day and drove us home. And he showed up at my court date, like some of us have court dates when we get here, shocking, right? And Ralph showed up with his life savings in his pocket, and I didn't know that until later. You know, that kind of love just still amazes me, you know? So Ralph stopped coming to meetings, and I asked Dave Garrick, Dave G, to be my sponsor. Dave, amazing guy, got sober young, 21 or so. He was involved in treatment centers, worked for Father Martin for years, and does some other stuff now, but just a wonderful human being. He and his wife, Nancy, were so good to us, and we were going through this, like, super religious phase, and so, like, he would pat me on the head and say, keep coming back, and I'd be like, well, okay, Dave, but you're going to hell, and he'd be like, keep coming back, it's okay, and thank God he loved me, you know. So let me tell this story. We were doing stuff together. He had three sons, and we had two kids at the time, and we were going to pools together in the summer, and, you know, we're in Maryland, and he says, let's go camping. I'm like, brilliant, I'm in. I don't know if Cindy wasn't all excited about it, but I was all about it, right? Let's go camping. So we go camping at Susquehanna State Park, and Dave says, let's go fishing. I'm like, yeah, let's go fishing. So we go down to the Susquehanna River, which is just below the Conowingo hydroelectric plant, so it's pretty fast. The water's pretty fast. The side of the river is all rocks, and they're slippery, you know, when it gets to be lower tide. And the kids are fishing from the side of the river, and basically Dave and I are taking off perch and spots and little fish, you know, maybe this big, showing them to the kids and then throwing them back in the water and then putting the worm on the hook. And they're fishing, and we're doing that. And we're doing it, and we're doing it, and I don't know, an hour goes by or so, and I turn around at one point, and my son's standing up on the bank, a little further up the bank, and he's crying. And I say, what's the matter? Why aren't you fishing? And he's crying. I dropped your fishing rod. I said, where'd you drop it? In the water. So I'm about four years sober. Here I come. You dropped my fishing rod. Oh, my God. Stomp, stomp, stomp. I'm stomping around on the riverbank, you know. How could you let this happen? You know, this is my fishing rod. I lose my mind, right, as a good person with 4 years sobriety does. And I'm stomping around. And I turn around, and I look at my three-year-old daughter, and she's just looking at me, shaking her head like, what an idiot, you know? And I look around, and there's Dave's kids, and they're kind of got the same look on their face, like, oh, geez, where do you find these guys, you know? And I turn around, here's my guru, my spiritual giant, Dave, and he's laughing. What an idiot. So I have an epiphany, and I walk up the bank, and I hug my son. I say, son, I'm sorry. It's just a fishing rod. We'll get another one. Don't worry about it. He's crying. Oh. I said, please, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I acted like an idiot. You know, you and Faith can share a fishing rod. And so we start fishing again. And a little while later, you know, we're fishing. Everybody's smiling, laughing, throwing fish back. And I hear a big splash. And I turn around, and my sponsor, Dave, he's a big guy. He's like 6'5". big guy, not like super coordinated, but a big tall guy, tall skinny guy. And he's in the water, and water's like rushing over him, you know, and it's not real deep, but he's all the way in. And so I run over and I try and help him out, and he had slipped on the rocks and fallen in trying to get a snag off or something. And so I pull him out of the water, and he comes out, and you know, everybody's scared, doesn't know what to say, and he says, "I'm fine." And so everybody starts laughing, and I look on his back, and my fishing rod is hooked on his back, right? I'm like, score! So this is how I learned it. And you let go and let God, you get your stuff back, you know? That's not true, by the way. I got to tell you, my experience is not that. But that it happened that time. That was how it happened that time. And, you know, surrender and step three have everything to do about showing up, you know, being present in my own life. As I show up, God gives me glimpses of growth, you know, flashes of what has to change, like me being an idiot when my son is a kid. So Ralph and I had worked the steps out of the book, and I thank God for Ralph. And Dave and I worked the steps, you know, out of the book and out of the 12 and 12. We also did a lot of service work together. Dave was a big 12-step guy. And I remember going into places with Dave, like nasty hotels and nasty apartments, never good apartments. You never go into a mansion, you know, pull, you know, down here you do, but up there we didn't, you know. So we would go into, like, these nasty places and talk to drunks who had called AA. And but what I remember about that is when we would go in, Dave would say, "You talk to him about step one and about the disease of alcoholism." And Dave would clean up, you know, he'd pick up the beer cans, you know, or whatever, and bottles. And what I also remember about that is we would pray in the car before we went in. And we would pray with the drunk guy every time. I remember that, you know. And so that taught me, you know, that right here, right now, that's what matters, you know. Dave taught me to do what's in front of me, right here, right now. God works right here, right now, right here, right now. He doesn't work tomorrow. You know, I would be worried about everything except for what was going on. And what Dave taught me was that 90% of my life is showing up. That's true at work, at home, at AA. But practicing the third and the 11th step is 100% showing up. Just do what's in front of you, John. Just do what's in front of you. And I'm so grateful for him for doing that. You know, the Gunpowder Group helped me to fall in love with service. I got involved in intergroup, later general service, H&I, jails all over Maryland. You know, what I learned at the Gunpowder Group was how to build a foundation for long-term sobriety. I don't hear people talking about that like I used to. Maybe it was just what I needed to hear, but built a foundation on the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what those guys taught me, you know. It's like, if you want to stay sober one day at a time for the rest of your life, then this is what we do. And I'm so grateful for that, you know, because it still works. So we moved to the panhandle of Florida. I'm really bad with dates. I always look at Cindy. Was that the late 90s? I don't know. Anyway. So I think it was the late 90s. But, you know, in Maryland, we had little kids, and we still had little kids when we moved to the, we still had one little kid when we moved to the panhandle, but we weren't going to conventions. Every year they had a convention in Hagerstown, Maryland, the Maryland State Convention, and I always wanted to go, and a lot of guys at Gunpowder went, but we couldn't really do it. We couldn't afford it, and we couldn't, you know, we couldn't get daycare and all that. So we moved to Florida, and the kids just started to grow up a little bit, and so we started getting involved in conventions, and we're at a convention in January one year, because it's a summer season up there. It's a tourist area. So we're in Fort Walton Beach at a convention, and there's a lady from California there, and she gets locked out on her balcony, and she almost missed speaking. And when she came down to speak, she was still shivering. And she said from the podium, "I thought I was in Florida. It's freezing here. What's wrong with you people, you know?" And the guy next to me, Dale W., leans over and he says, "We should have a convention in the summer." And I'm like, "Yeah, we should." So we started a convention in the summer. It's still going on up there, summer serenity at the beach. And Dale's, you know, not doing well right now, but again, a lot of those people are still involved and still sober. And what that did for me was it got me involved in conventions on a level that I'd never been. So I was a merchant marine, so I listened to a lot of CDs, we used to have tapes. There were these cassette, and some of you don't even know. But anyway, now when we had CDs, and so I knew a lot of those. I'd listened to a lot of those guys, and I got on the speaker selection committee because there was like five guys putting the whole thing together, right? Or five guys and gals. So I got to be involved in that because that was one of the things I loved. And I got to meet people that I adored, you know, from their CDs. And some of them I didn't like after the convention. I'm like, ooh, that guy, not so much. But some of them I just absolutely fell in love with. So I want to talk about Jay and Bill. So I asked Bill Cleveland to come speak for us because I loved his CD. And I said, well, we happen to have all these other open spots. Do you know anybody? He says, well, my sponsor, Jay, and I do a sponsorship workshop. And, you know, ask him. Maybe he can do it. I was like, okay, so we get Jay to come. So Jay, and they're like the odd couple. Hey, they're so funny. Bill's this big, tall, bald-headed guy. And Jay's this, like, little round, long-haired California dude. And I hated him instantly. And he says, you know, we're spending time with them because you have to when you're doing that kind of thing. And Jay was like a close talker, too, man. I don't know if you remember that Seinfeld episode, but he was a close talker. Get right up in my face. Hey, John, how you doing, man? I'm like, geez, hey, back off, dude. And he would say, hey, John, you know how you know what you're doing is God's will? I'm like, no, Jay. And my eyes are rolling. No, Jay. How do I know what I'm doing is God's will? Because it's what you're doing. I'm like, oh, really? Really? We got to get a guy from California to come in here and give me this? Are you kidding me? I hated him. And so through the weekend, you know, and then he did his sponsorship workshop. It was amazing. And Bill was great. And so then just hanging out with him, I was like, what he did was he encouraged us. He asked me questions that I thought were so personal because we had come through this, like, cult. We called ourselves Baptists, but we were a cult. And so we got through that, thank God. And you know, we moved to the Panhandle, and I was, you know, my spirituality was the big book in the 12 and 12, which is great, you know, but I wasn't really doing anything else. He's like, so, John, what's your meditation life look like? I'm like, that's kind of personal, Jay. Back off, man, and quit getting in my face, by the way. And he's like, so he was like, what are you reading? I'm like, Stephen King. He's like, yeah, that's okay, you know, but you might try something a little more uplifting. I'm like, you might try backing off. And he's like, Cindy, what are you reading? She always gets the gold star. Well, I'm reading Course of Miracles. He's like, John, you ought to try that. I'm like, yeah, you ought to shut the heck up, you know. Anyway, it was just great. So all we, you know, it was only like 5 days, but it kind of changed my life because it made me realize that my spiritual life could be a lot deeper than it was. And, you know, so Bill and Jay gave me that only because we got involved in conventions. And you know, we got to see him in Atlanta at the International and give him a hug on the floor there. That was wonderful to see them. I hadn't seen him in ages, so that was cool. So I'm trying to fast forward here. In 2008, we moved to South Florida. And, you know, what happened was basically I blew up my financial life by thinking I was a genius, and I wasn't as smart as I thought I was. I got involved with a guy who I signed some documents that I shouldn't have signed, and he ended up suing me when everything went to crap in 2008. And basically sued me into my next lifetime. So pretty much a quarter of my check goes to that guy every week. And when I moved to Fort Lauderdale, I moved to for a job, number one, but a lot of it was just to not act out on the homicidal feelings I was having. And I don't talk about that a lot of meetings, but I was really filled with resentment. I had 16 years of sobriety, and I was full of resentment, full of fear. You know, I had been a guy who bought cars for his kids, you know. I couldn't do that anymore. I was a guy who had, been all that in a bag of chips, and now I was a guy who was, working for a paycheck again and not real happy about it. And what happened when I moved to Fort Lauderdale was I joined Dry Dock. I went every night. I started exercising again, which I needed to do, and I got re-involved in AA. I got a new sponsor who helped me, He jokingly says that a friend will help you, a good friend will help you hide the body. I was like, I'm pretty sure that's not what we need to do, but tell me more. and so we didn't have to do that, thank God. But, what happened was, my world crashed down, and my worst fears were realized. I couldn't buy my daughter, my youngest daughter, the car. I couldn't buy my wife the car that I wanted to buy her. And somehow we ate, and we made it through, and we did okay. And the joy has kind of been in the rebuilding. My youngest adult just graduated from UCF, and she's in a graduate program there, pretty much all her own doing. Really smart kid and really on track for what she wants. Our oldest is involved with a wonderful young lady. They're going to have a baby. So I'm going to be a grandpa, which is kind of freaking me out, but it's good. And the middle child is engaged to a really great guy who she met in college, and they're doing well, living in Orlando area. So what's happened was everybody in our family lived through my worst fears. And they all succeeded one day at a time. And because I'm not in charge, right? God's in charge. And I keep remembering, I keep learning that over and over. And that the joy is in the little victories, It's in rebuilding and staying close as a family. All three of our adult children know where we are. All three of our adult children can get a hold of me. And they'll call. If I don't answer, they know I'm either dealing with a drunk or a work thing, and I'll call them back. They don't have any fear of who I am or how I am or what I'm going through. They know that I'll show up. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me that. They know that Friday nights, Cindy and I will be at Zona Fresca eating dang quesadillas before the meditation meeting, because that's what we do. It's really exciting, I know. Calm down. But that's what we do. They know we're going to be at area quarterlies. They trust us, and AA gave us that. As imperfect as I've been as a husband and a father, I haven't been drunk, which is huge, right, for a guy like me. My family knows I love them, and I'm here now, right here, now with God. So I sponsored a guy recently. He's got 10-year-old twins, and he says, I want to be a dad. And I say, if you keep getting drunk, that's not going to happen. And that's been my experience. The sad fact is, if he keeps going the way he's going, he'll get to be a memory and probably not a really good one. And that's sad and tragic, but that's alcoholism. The flip side of that is he could get sober. He could do what he needs to get sober and stay sober. I don't know of any worse hell than of abandoning the people who love you and who you love. And that's what I do when I drink. I abandon you. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and guys like Ralph and guys like Dave and guys like Arnold and Jay, people here, teach me to abandon myself to God, whatever that is, however that looks. And when I do that, I'm available to you. It's amazing. It's awesome, right? For a guy like me, it's the lottery, man. Not the lottery, but anyway. I want to talk about some AA heroes. John Packard, I talked about, chaired my first meeting, still a friend. My first sponsor, Ralph, Dave, Paul Wright, Tom E. Tom E. was a guy, we called him Johnny AA Seed. Everywhere that guy went, he started a meeting. It's amazing. And he started meetings all over Baltimore County, Harford County, started a place called the Serenity Club, which was, when I came in, the smoke was so thick you had to swim through it, and Tom was sick with cancer. He had lung cancer, go figure. And he was full of chemo. He's all bloated. About a month before he passed, he's in my home group. It wasn't his home group. He was in my home group, and somebody called on him, and he was crying. talking about how grateful he was for Alcoholics Anonymous and what Alcoholics Anonymous had done in his life. The guy's dying. I got like 5 years of sobriety, and I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, man, I want that. You know, whatever that is, I want it, because that's God. I don't know how you do that, you know, but Tom was amazing. Spiro, I mean, all these guys helped us in the beginning. Derby used to say, John, you're throwing in the towel, but you're holding on to a corner. Let go of the corner. I'm like, shut up. Tell me what to do. Rita and Al, Cindy talked about Rita and Al. Amazing human beings who saved our lives. I think they used to invite us over. They had a pool, you know. We'd go over there and eat crabs. I didn't know you could eat crabs and not drink beer, but you could. Turns out you can. Iced tea, go figure. And Rita and I think they'd take our kids outside and say, you know, hey, your parents are nuts. Just keep coming back, you know. But they did. They loved us because we were so ill. And then the people I've met through speakers, through conferences, Cliff Roach, Sharon Barker Crane, you know, Bill Anderson. I mean, these people, man, if you're lucky like me, you get to fall in love with the people in AA. The spiritual life is not a theory. It must be lived. It's available. You know, it's available right here, right now, in this moment. Lots of amazing people stay sober in the trenches helping other people. People like the committee here. People like a lot of y'all here. I know I'm speaking to the choir, but you know, if you have the ability, and like my wife, if you have the ability to stay sober in a house with a fellow sufferer, God bless you, because it ain't easy, but it's worth it. Ain't that right, baby? you see her after, and she'll tell you. You know, Cindy's been all in from the very start, Al-Anon, AA, ACA, she's the real deal. So thank you, Cindy, for showing me what real strength looks like. So life happens. I struggle with my own issues. Everybody does. The point is we grow along spiritual lines. And what does that mean? I'm not sure what it means for you, but for me, I learn what it means every day when I pick up the phone, when somebody calls. You know, Cleveland taught me to pick up the phone, don't look, don't screen your calls. And that's hard for a guy who's got creditors on his butt, because I had creditors on my butt for a while. Don't anymore, thank God. But, you know, I pick up my phone, John Karwacki, how can I help you? Don't look at who's calling. And that's not easy for a guy like me. But, you know, that's how I learn what God's will is for me. Every time I read the book with somebody, every day is a day I must carry the vision of God's will into all my affairs. I can't stay sober by myself. And I thank you all for my sobriety. God bless you.